Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, South Bay Spotlight, on January 28th, 2016. Live, love, laugh, and leave a legacy. That's what we do here in the South Bay of Los Angeles, and it's a beautiful place to do just that. I'm your host, Joe Terry.
The South Bay Show is brought to you by the Academy of Foreign Languages. If you have any interest in learning a new language or brushing up on existing language skills, you should know about the Academy of Foreign Languages. Located in Palos Verdes, the Academy of Foreign Languages specializes in the art of communication. Their mission is to provide the finest language instruction possible. They recognize that each student has distinctive needs and craft their teaching technique to optimize an individual's particular learning skills. At the Academy of Foreign Languages, they strive to create a comfortable environment conducive to learning. So whether you're learning a new language or would simply like to converse in your native tongue, the Academy of Foreign Languages can accommodate you. For additional information, visit their website at academyofforeignlanguages.com, that's all spelled out, or call 310-975-4133.
You can read all about our many adventures on Facebook at facebook.com/The South Bay Show. Persistence, passion, principle, and purpose. That's what we talk about on The South Bay Show. And, of course, I'm not alone because of our great partnership with SouthBayByJackie.com and producer of The South Bay Show, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today?
Good morning, Joe. It's another beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Another beautiful day. Can you believe it? They say it's going to be 80 degrees today.
Are you kidding me? Really?
That's what I heard.
Now we all know that you believe in weathermen. Yesterday you told me it was going to be nice, but there were actually kind of these weird clouds all day. I actually thought it was going to rain, but it never did.
They lied to me yesterday.
I've been telling you this for years. They lied to everybody.
And I hope they're trying to redeem themselves.
Yeah, well, look, I get my weather by looking out my window. I'm not listening to those weathermen. I just don't trust them.
Right.
They're a bunch of charlatans.
Right. Yeah, and in the 60s they were a domestic terrorist group. So you can't trust them.
Yeah.
It's amazing, Jackie. As long as both you and I have lived in the South Bay, we are always discovering new things. Now, of course, there's always, you know, new and amazing people moving into the South Bay, and that's one thing to discover. Great restaurants always forming every year.
Right, but new restaurants opening, shops opening, new businesses coming to the area, yeah.
But something that's been here since, what, the 40s?
30s, I think.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, this is.
And to just be finding out about it now.
It's one of the, it's an Olympic sport, Jackie, and it's something that I think people here in the South Bay really would be interested in knowing more about.
It's one of the best kept secrets, I think.
I think so, and we have two experts to talk about it with us, Jackie. Who are our guests today?
Our guests this morning are Dean Schoppe and Peter Steinbrunner from the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club. Dean Schoppe is a resident of Manhattan Beach and president of HL Classic Corporation. He began playing badminton at 15 years old and played juniors for the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club through 1976. He then went on to play for California State University, Dominguez Hills. He was a member of the USA national team from 1989 through 93 and the winner of the San Paulo Brazil Open 1998-2000 men's doubles. Dean was a finalist or semifinalist in the Open World Rankings tournaments in Puerto Rico, Cuba, Mexico, Guatemala, and the U.S. from 1999 to 2008. He began teaching and coaching at Manhattan Beach Badminton Club when he was 17. He worked 7 years with the Jim Poole Academy of Badminton and was an instructor for 10 years at the George Washington University Badminton Camps. Dean was a former USBA National Junior Development Committee chairperson, a USBA Olympic Player Development Committee member, and USBA Pan American rep for 12 years. He was awarded the Ken Davidson Memorial Sportsmanship Award in 1993, the NAGWS President's Award in 2000, and the Del Valle Sportsmanship Award in 1976. Now, Peter Steinbrunner was the 1972 junior national champion in 18 and under boys doubles, the 1975 national collegiate champion representing California State University Dominguez Hills, and California State singles and doubles team champion, again representing CSUDH. Again, he is a member of the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club. He's been a member of the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club since 1977 and was president in 2010. So, Joe, this morning we're going to learn the history of the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club and the upcoming U.S. Olympic Badminton qualifying tournament stop on the road to Rio 2016, which will take place at Manhattan Beach Badminton Club February 3rd through February 7th. So, Dean, Peter, welcome to the program. We are so glad you could join us this morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to both of you, Dean and Peter. This is, as we've been saying, it is something that most people in the South Bay are not familiar with. And we just want to know more about the game itself. Can you tell us, let's start with you, Dean. What is badminton?
Well, what badminton is really probably one of the most popular four or five sports in the world currently, particularly in terms of player participation. It's hugely popular in all of Asia and all of Northwest Europe. We here in the United States have had a very organized sport since the 1930s, as you know, when the badminton club began here in Manhattan Beach. But the sport itself is played with, of course, a very, very light badminton racket, which weighs probably 3.5 to 4 ounces. The shuttlecock, which is made up of either 16 goose feathers or with a nylon skirt. The bird or the shuttle will travel upwards to 200 miles an hour. The record smash is like 300 miles an hour, but it travels around 200 miles an hour when it leaves the racket with most of us. And players, what's really cool about badminton, and the reason it is so popular worldwide, is that it takes a relatively small amount of area to have a badminton court, and the better you get at badminton, the more proficient you get at hitting the bird and moving, the harder it becomes physically. So it has an upward trajectory in terms of the exercise and the value you get out of the time you spend playing it. It can be played by anybody from any age. We have children playing at our club that are 6 years old and players playing in their 90s. And you have players with Paralympians, and you have special needs kids that play badminton. Because the racket is so light and the shuttlecock is so light, the initial beginning process is actually easier than almost any other sport in terms of a racket sport or a sport that uses implements like a baseball bat or whatever. And yet the better you get, the harder it becomes, to the point when you hit the Olympic level, like a lot of these players that we're going to see here in Manhattan Beach next week, you're having players that register as the very highest O2 athletes in the entire Olympic Training Center, the athletes that have to be in the greatest condition, because it becomes more and more difficult physically to play the game as you move up the ladder of proficiency. It's really a remarkable sport. And here in the U.S., of course, it really flies under the radar as a professional sport, unless, of course, you live in San Francisco area where there's, 14 full-time badminton clubs with 20 courts each, or you're watching a worldwide sports channel or whatever that emanates out of Asia. Then badminton's on TV every single day, and all of the big tournaments. There's tournaments with, there's none of the big tournaments like tennis with millions of dollars, but there's badminton tournaments that get up to $1 million in prize money, and so it is very, very popular throughout the world.
Wow. That is quite a history, and that's very informative. And when you talk about the O2 utilization, I mean, most people know or perhaps have been on one of those treadmills where they're measuring how well your body utilizes oxygen, and it actually is a measure of how efficient your body is. And now athletes are being rated, and as you say, some athletes are better than others, and the ones at the very top are extremely good at utilizing oxygen. And Minton players ranked near the top? How does that work?
Well, in Colorado Springs at the Olympic Training Center, when we still had our teams training up there full-time, we no longer do because we don't play a majority of our tournaments at high altitude, and Colorado Springs is as high as it gets for a training center.
Yeah.
But when we used to be up there for about 7 or 8 years, we would come in number one almost every single year with our athletes as a group. And the reason is that in badminton you run anywhere from maybe 1 to 3 miles of these little sprints, and these little sprints involve of moving maybe 1.5 to 2.5 steps with a jump and a change of direction. And you do this repetitively over and over and over again. And in badminton, unlike tennis where they get quite a bit of time to break in between points, badminton has a rule that's called continuous play. So you're lucky if they give you a 20 or a 30-second break in between a point. So you may have just hit a one-minute rally of moving around the court and hitting the shuttle back and forth at maybe 8 tenths or 9 tenths of a second in between each shot. So you're jumping from corner to corner, and a badminton court's 44 feet. So if you're jumping from the center and taking 1.5 steps and traveling out, you're traveling 15 feet out or 12 feet out and 12 feet back. You're traveling 24 steps, 24 feet on every single shot, and you're doing that 100 times. That's a lot of feet, and it adds up really fast. So the athletes just absolutely have to be in phenomenal shape or they break down. They might last 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 minutes, and then they start to break down and they make errors like any other athlete. That's why guys miss free throws at the ends of games and they get tired.
Right.
So badminton players historically have had to be really, really, really well conditioned, and that those years at the Olympic Training Center really were an excellent opportunity to demonstrate just how good a shape they had to be in.
Right. Wow.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. It's pretty hard. It's pretty funny.
There's a lot of professional athletes who use badminton as conditioning, football players and baseball players.
When you look at the court, you can see that it would easily fit in a backyard, a large backyard, but not a huge backyard, and you could fully fit a badminton court in that space.
That's true, and in fact, you know, not so much anymore, but back in the day, back in the 40s and 50s, post-World War II, you'd go to a lot of the really nice homes, and of course, you know, the South Bay down here, we didn't really develop until the 1960s, and like Manhattan Beach and places, but you go back into Burbank and Glendale and Pasadena, and you go to those really nice homes, and those badminton courts that were built just after World War II or just before World War II, because of all of the movie star influence and the sport and whatever, they're still there. I've had friends of mine that are in the industry move to some of these houses and call me up and say, hey, man, there's a badminton court in my house. You know, they weren't using it as a badminton court, but it was built exactly as you just said, beautiful cement, perfect courts, outdoors, perfectly usable in the morning before there's wind.
Right. Wow. That's fantastic. So we want to learn a little bit about the two of you gentlemen. Peter, how long have you lived in the South Bay?
We moved here to Manhattan Beach in 1965, and our next-door neighbors were members of the badminton club, and so we joined in 1966. We were only two blocks from the club, and they sent me up there to play, and I quit a couple of times because it was – there were so many kids that played at the club, and it was, you know, hard to get a time on a court and all. And my parents kept sending me up, and then I caught the bug, and then I haven't left.
Well, I mean, really, 1972 junior national champion in 18 and under boys doubles, and 1975 national collegiate champion representing California State University, Dominguez Hills. That's fantastic.
That was a lot of fun. Matter of fact, the funny thing about 1975, my doubles partner, Mike Kelly, who lived across the street from the club, I had recruited him to come to Dominguez Hills. It was my junior year, and suddenly we had a team. But we had the smallest team of all of the California State universities and junior colleges and all. We played at Hayward, And here we were the smallest team, but we won the state championships.
Yeah.
Because we met each other in the finals and singles, and we won the doubles. And they changed the rules that year and required that you had to have so many different players and at different levels and all. And so the next year we came back, and the other players weren't that good that we brought, but we still came in second place.
Yeah, right. And, of course, Peter, there are men's singles, women's singles, men's doubles, women's doubles, and mixed doubles. So there is a an official sort of game for just about anyone.
Correct, correct. Matter of fact, there's the Sudermann Cup, which just was recently played, is an event much like the Davis Cup. We have our Thomas Cup and Huber Cup, which are the men and women's divisions for badminton.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have the Sudermann Cup, which is for a mixed team, which is a nice event.
Yeah, the mixed doubles is we're the only sport in all of the Olympics that actually has direct head-to-head competition with men and women on the same court, as opposed to judged events.
Mm.
That's sort of unique.
That's interesting. The only competition with men...
Head-to-head competition as opposed to a judged event, like, you know, skating and all of
okay.
all of the
yeah.
judged events have a lot of dual-gender competitions, but we're the only one where you actually square off and head-to-head compete against each other in the same manner you would compete with men or single-gender events.
Right, right. And, of course, badminton is often, competitively, it's always played indoors. Is that right?
Yes, for the most part. There's almost that I've ever heard of in my life, and I've been all over the world. It's indoors. You wouldn't know it when you're in a 15 or 16,000 seat arena and it's packed with people that has its own weather.
Yeah.
And the birdie blows around as if it was outdoor, sometimes 2 or 3 feet one direction or the other. So you have to make the same corrections you would as if you were playing outdoors in the morning.
Mm.
So a lot of players do hit around a lot outdoors just for the sake of getting used to that.
That's very interesting. Very interesting.
We have a number of our playing members who are from, you know, around the world. Sort of like I look at it as our United Nations, because it's we have people from Russia and Indonesia, Malaysia, Japan, and we always ask, you know, so when did you start? And they said, well, you know, it was in the neighborhood, and you know, we just played outdoors, and that's how a lot of the people learn is by playing outdoors, because they don't require a gym, and they use their skills to, you know, learn the basic strokes and all that, and then. Somebody usually picks somebody out and says, you know, you're pretty good, and they get involved with the club. So it's just like here, you see kids going out to play baseball outdoors.
Right.
In places like Indonesia, Malaysia, China, there's a lot of outdoor badminton. But once a kid is picked, then they go indoors because of the wind issue. And you've got lines, and it's more formalized.
The Manhattan Beach Badminton Club, founded in 1936. Where is the club?
Well, we're located at the corner of 18th Street and Ardmore.
Okay.
And a lot of people drive by it all the time. They don't know what it is. They think it's a phone company or a water tower or something. But we've got 5 courts, swimming pool, a lounge, downstairs kitchen, bathrooms, a play area for kids. We have 7 lots
mm-hmm.
that were purchased in 1940.
Wow.
And the funny thing is, back then, because of badminton's popularity of these movie stars, that was sort of in the 30s, a lot of magazines came out about the movie stars that played badminton, like James Cagney and Betty Davis and Ginger Rogers and Joan Crawford and Douglas Fairbanks. So a lot of people thought this is really a glamorous thing, and the original badminton club group played at the Marine Avenue Pavilion, which was right there on the beach. It was a 2-story frame building. Downstairs was a restaurant and a bathhouse, and upstairs was a dance hall. And it was only like 15 feet high, so they rented it out, and the problem was that 15 feet is not high enough. The courts at our club are 30 feet.
Right.
So after there were like 20 couples, and they said decided, you know what, in 1936, we'd like to have our own club. So that sort of was the genesis of the Badminton Club, in that they sat down and said, okay, now how are we going to raise the money for this? And they, Luke Busby was a forming member, and he went out looking around at property and all. Mm-hmm. And but how do we come up with the money? So these members put together a musical comedy called April Follies, and they rented out the Pier Avenue School in Hermosa Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all done in-house. They did the costumes and the music and all. And over several weekends, they raised a couple thousand dollars. And with that money, Luke went out and he bought 7 lots in what was called the backcountry, because there was nothing out there. It was just sand.
Oh, I want 7 lots in the backcountry.
I want 7 lots in the
backcountry. Yeah.
Oh,
now
my
it is. Now, you will laugh, because but nobody had money back then, 1940. And the lots were, as I understand, about $220 a lot. And these had all gone to, you know, tax liens and all that. So they settled all that. Now, years later, I met someone, one of the founding members, and I asked, I said, geez, what would it have been like if you would have bought the land on the Strand?
Right.
And he said, oh, well, you know what, that was more expensive. Those lots went for $1,200 a piece, and there was a woman who owned the lots, all of the lots between Marine and Rosecrans.
Yeah.
And she was, you know, trying to sell them, and she couldn't. But that was
Oh my goodness.
the other irony with the Badminton Club was is that there was no 18th Street, so they literally had to build and create 18th Street just to get the project started, from what I understand.
Wow. Well,
they went to the city and asked the city to build it, and the city said, we don't have any money. So right. 18th Street ended at our parking lot.
Right. Well, it is I'm looking at it from the air on Google Maps, and it is a fantastic facility. Right across Ardmore, it's on Ardmore, then you look down towards Valley Drive, and you'll look at Live Oak Park. But it's right across from Live Oak Park, 516 18th Street. What a gorgeous facility, and
yeah,
a very nice pool.
It's state of the art. It's by today's standards, the ceiling, as great as the ceiling is and was at its time, by today's standards, if you were to try to play, you know, a multi-million-dollar tournament or whatever, you'd get some blowback, because our ceiling is technically too low, which is hard to believe. But I guess the athletes to become bigger and stronger than they were, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Hmm.
But the facility, honestly, and I've played everywhere in the world, our facility is as good or better than any facility in the world. Even the really beautiful Canadian and European clubs, and we probably don't have the incredible go-with of some of the places in Peru or Mexico or places where you get huge clubs that are multi-sport. But for a badminton-only facility, honestly, there's really nowhere better that I've ever encountered for badminton-only.
Wow. Okay.
And now, Joe and I did not know about this.
Right.
Joe and I had no idea that the club existed. Every time now I drive through that area, I'm going to be looking for it. I'm going to find it. I mean, I'm sure I've seen it,
right,
but I had no idea what it was.
Right.
Well, it's well hidden behind those trees, and you just don't see it. It's built going up the side of, you know, they used to have ice plant or whatever in front of it. So you, like Peter said, you just assumed it was another one of those little electrical substations or something.
Right. Or someone's home that's turned into a compound or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's beautiful. It's obviously surrounded by homes, and so let's talk about details. Like the website is mbbadmintonclub.com. So that's easy. MB, as in Manhattan Beach, badmintonclub.com.
Now let's not go any further than that. Let's get with what we were talking about earlier, Joe, because you and I made the same mistake, and I'm sure a lot of people do.
Yes.
The spelling.
Yes.
Yes.
Peter, or let's start with you, Dean. Most people don't pronounce it correctly.
That's true.
Why is that?
Well, you know, I don't know actually why that is, but I do know it to be true because what I do for a living is badminton. And I think it's because, just like in so many words in English, people start thinking it's badminton with the two T's as opposed to badminton with N. So it's B-A-D-M-I-N-T-O-N. And the irony is that the name itself, the genesis of the name badminton, has really nothing to do with the description of the sport or anything else. It has to do with a house or a big manor, actually, in England, where a lady in the 1800s got a badminton set. She got a set of what they call Poona out of India from her uncle, who brought it back. He was a colonel in the British Army. And he brings back this set with this shuttlecock thing and this racket with skins, not even strings. And she bats this thing back and forth with a servant 1700 or 1800 times in a row. And then she writes to the government of England to tell them about her great accomplishment. They don't have a name for what she did, so they named it after this house.
Right.
So it doesn't have any real genesis in our language at all. So it gets misspelled all the time.
Right.
Yeah. When Peter sent me some literature on the club, and I'm reading it, and I'm like, "Huh, is this a typo?" and then I realized I've been misspelling it and mispronouncing it for my entire life. Which, as I said, I'm not the only one because I know Joe did it too.
Oh no.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No,
it was the Earl of Badminton, and it was his manor where they all came, and they said, "Geez, we had such a good time. Let's go back." And the name sort of stuck. It's sort of like the name for sandwich came from the Earl of Sandwich. Why?
Right.
He figured, well, if I take two pieces of bread and put something in between, that's everybody said, "Geez, that's a great idea," and they named it after him. So.
So
good to be first.
It is always good to be first. So, Dean, how can someone become a member? How does that work?
Well, the membership at the club is a private club, mm-hmm. so, and it's a social club. Mm-hmm. So the way it works is you have to know two other members that sponsor you in, mm-hmm. and this is for a regular membership. They sponsor you in. You come and fill out an application, and first you come over and check it out, make sure it's something you really want to do. But all of that being pre-assumed, you then go and meet the board members. You come to a couple of functions where you meet people and make sure that it's something you want to do and be involved with, and then you kind of wait in line because usually, and I'm going to defer this one to Peter at this point because he'll know, he'll be more exact because he's actually on the board. Peter, what is the process and what's the wait?
Well, the thing is that once you put your application into the queue, the wait list is around 4 years. Because
wow.
we're not like any other club where they sell you like a membership. You walk in, you sell a membership, and they know that 90% of the people aren't going to show up. We only have 250 regular memberships, so we're really limited as to who we can bring in. You can only come in after someone leaves or passes away or quits or whatever. So
right.
Once you get your application in and once you get to the top of the line, then you go in and meet the board, and the board approves you. So it's in many respects, we are a co-op. And that we require the members to also participate, since they are owners in the club. Everyone is issued a share, so the board meets once a month, and then we come to the members with our ideas about things, and we have two meetings a year, and the members vote on it. So it's a real democracy in many respects. So once the members in, we give them a key, and they have a full run of the club. With our pool, we have a swim instructor, and there's a nice outdoor barbecue, and we have a lot of social events. So it's a real kind of family-oriented club.
And being not for profit, there's no profit incentive in the club because there's just no management or whatever. Everybody's volunteer. So aside from the swimming instructor and the badminton coach, the full-time badminton coach, everybody else is a volunteer. The other area where people join the club is called a playing member. So if there's some gung-ho badminton player out there listening that used to play in the old country, which is where most of the playing members come from, but we have a playing membership where the badminton player would then find a member somehow, and there's you always know somebody. You just don't know it because you haven't asked them. And you get that member to bring you in as a guest, because you have to be invited as a guest to come in, and that member would bring you in and as a guest, and you play badminton. And if you're gung-ho and you're a badminton player, the badminton club is always open-armed to play the sport, because, again, in the United States, it is sort of a niche sport. And so we get one or two new members. I know Peter, you're involved in this. We've had some pretty unique, cool members coming in recently, like places like India. We've got a new Japanese member. We have, as Peter mentioned earlier, we've got a couple of people from Russia, a couple of doctors. And it's really, really a cool, like Peter said, it's the United Nation of sports in the South Bay.
Right.
So this club has been located in Manhattan Beach since the 30s. It's kind of hidden. A lot of people aren't aware of it. So is your membership, do you get, you said that you have a limited number of memberships and there's currently a four-year wait. Mm-hmm. So are there local people, like, for instance, say, okay, so both of you, your family, so you started, you know, there when you were kids and grew up. Now, did your kids want to be members of it as they grew up, or were there neighborhood kids running around going, wow, that looks like fun, I want to become a member, and they grow up to become members, or is it more through the badminton playing community that you get? Like, are your members coming from Pasadena and downtown and Orange County?
No, most of the members come from Manhattan Beach. They're neighbors of members, just like what Peter described in his case, that his next-door neighbors brought his family in. In my case, I was born into the club. My dad was a member, like, in 1960, and I was born in 56. So by the time I could walk, I knew, you know, that's where I was. In my case, my children moved away to Oregon and lived up there. And my son has recently come back to live here in the South Bay in the last year or so. And he comes up as a guest a couple times a month to play. But he never grew up playing too much badminton. He went to MiraCosta and stuff, but he played other sports. And so what happens with a lot of the kids in badminton, our offspring, is I find, anyway, is that a lot of times they don't keep playing after juniors. They go on and they play in college. They do some other stuff. They go away, and then they come back. They come back later as they come back to the South Bay. But most of our members really come from the community.
Wow. So those kids that get out of it and go on and move or something, and they come back, they got to get on a wait list if they want to get back in.
Well, Peter, you address
what we do is those adult children of former members, we do help them out on the list to make sure that they get in. We find a lot of people, life gets in the way. People want to live in the South Bay, but work, school, they get married, and eventually they all come back, though, which is interesting, because we always have somebody who says, I grew up in the club, and you go, well, what's your parents' name? And they say, oh, my God, that's great. Oh, I remember you. A lot of people have very, very fond memories of the club growing up. We have a very robust junior program. We sponsor the MiraCosta High School team, which has done really well in the past, coming in second in CIF several years in a row. So, we're the objective of the club, the mission statement of the club, is to promote badminton. And I always like to see the look on people's face, because everyone always says, I played that in college, or I played that as a kid. And the trick is to get them to cut back a little bit on their work schedule and come up to the club. The coach gives, free lessons to these new members to get them involved. Dean holds these really great seminars for beginners and intermediate players. The great thing about badminton, I think, is at whatever level, even a beginner can volley the bird back and forth and hit it a number of times, whereas if you play tennis, I just found that you pick up the ball most of the time. You know, two beginner players can have a very vigorous game, and then it's just a matter of, you know, the more you play, the better you get, and it's always a great joy to see a player who gets it and starts playing a lot and practicing and really kind of moves up their skill level and starts to play with, you know, the rest of us or starts playing tournaments and all. So it's kind of a fun thing.
I'm curious, you mentioned MiraCosta team. Are there other schools in the South Bay that have badminton clubs?
So South Bay specifically, nobody else has a team. So this is CIF teams, just like any other CIF sport. We even have a conference state championships now for high school badminton throughout the state of California. Here in the South Bay, MiraCosta is the only one with a team. West High School has a really strong club program. Both the PV schools have strong clubs, and we keep talking about trying to get them on board to adding, a team. You run into issues with the high schools. Redondo Beach High School has great badminton, but they have the facilities. The problem is gym time, right? You're up against, especially here in the South Bay, you're up against year-round club volleyball. You're up against, for gym time at the high school, you're up against basketball, which is now year-round. In the old days, quote, 10 years ago, there was a rule in the CIF that was called the association rule, and the coaches couldn't associate with their players outside of their season. So it allowed for more gym time to be available. But now they've eliminated that rule in order to better compete against club teams so that the high school team can stay together year-round. So now you have year-round programs for sports like volleyball and basketball, and you've got both genders competing for gym time. So it's a very difficult area here, like the South Bay, to get gymnasium time. So fortunately for MiraCosta, as Peter mentioned, the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club steps into the gap and allows the MiraCosta team to actually practice and play their matches at the club, which is allowable under CIF rules. And it doesn't impact the programs over at MiraCosta High School, which preceded the badminton.
Wow. Now, is badminton a year-round sport, too?
Well, it is for all the kids at Manhattan Beach and all the kids that play, quote-unquote, on the tour of junior tours. Players play absolutely year-round. But we've got some great players. One of our best kids here from Manhattan Beach is a young man named Sam Schwartz, and our best girl, female player is Yoshi Cohn. Both of them, ironically, and they really are our two standout junior players, and they're the two standout players at MiraCosta High School as well. They play basketball. I don't want to say they're specifically AYSO, but they play year-round sports. They don't just play badminton, which is really unusual because most of the kids, and I go around the country coaching, most of the kids that are big into the badminton, year-round, they're single sport only. Our kids in Manhattan Beach over the years, whether we had Chad Narrative from Costa, who was great, he was number three in the country as a junior in badminton. He played his entire high school career playing basketball. He played baseball. He played badminton. He played soccer. And as these other two athletes do that we have now. So we're sort of unique in that sense. But most of the time it's a year-round, you know, single sport only kind of a sport like any other sport nowadays. So much specialization goes on.
Wow,
that's amazing. And the colleges do Southern California colleges, is it standard in, say, at USC and UCLA? I know Dominguez Hills and Long
Beach,
Irvine.
So in the state of California, we're the only state that actually has official sanctioned teams in what they call the CCCAA, which is the Community College Association for Athletics. So we have women's badminton teams at El Camino, for example, at Compton College. In the regular universities, we don't have full-fledged teams. We have club teams. The strongest is UCLA. USC is very, very good. Irvine is really good. Berkeley, Stanford, very, very strong teams throughout this. However, as I mentioned earlier about the mixed doubles thing and us being the only competition where it's head-to-head, the NCAA doesn't allow head-to-head competition. And when badminton reformed after being part of what they call the AIAW and the NCAA absorbed them, the NCAA sort of laid it out to the badminton people at the time that they had the option of going back to men's teams and women's teams like they have in tennis. And the badminton people coming off of the high of having us added to the Olympic Games said, no, we play mixed. Mixed is part of our repertoire. That's what we do at the Olympics. We really insist on having mixed. And the NCAA came back and said, no, we have men's and women's teams, and you can play simultaneous if you want. But generally, they play at different, you know, men's teams play in the fall and women's teams play in the spring. And badminton said, no, we play mixed. And the NCAA said, well, we're not going to do it. So consequently, Peter and I were very fortunate to play in the era that we did when we actually had, when Peter was able to become a collegiate national champion. Now those opportunities, gosh, people used to get scholarships. It was far different. So currently, it's all club team stuff. They do travel. They travel pretty extensively throughout the state of California. And the junior colleges are actually the ones that have the real teams, but they're single gender. They're only women.
What about the club teams? Are they single gender or are they co-ed?
No, the club teams are all co-ed, and they play an informal, because it's not an official sport.
Right.
They play an informal schedule. But they travel. I know our UCLA and SCs travel to San Diego constantly, and they're up to Northern California, and they're all back and forth. They really have a great time.
Wow, that's so interesting. What's up with the NCAA insisting on not allowing mix? That's silly.
It's just one of those things. We're the only sport. They used to have there's only two or three tournaments left in tennis that even offer it that are professional. I think Wimbledon being one of them. They just don't play it anymore.
Yeah.
Well, it all came on the heels of the Title IX when everybody woke up and said, wait a minute, the women's sport should be at the same level as the men's sports. Unfortunately, I think it's taken a couple steps backwards because you don't see some of those sports like badminton out like they were.
Right.
There was real emphasis at all the colleges. I was at Dominguez Hills. I was recruited by UCLA and said, we'll give you a full scholarship. And I'm like, that's great. Now, can any of my classes transfer over? And they said, no, because it's a different college system. So that's why I didn't move over to UCLA.
I see. Wow.
Gosh, I don't know about you, Joe. I'm learning a ton here today.
It's not only is it fascinating to learn about the history of the club, but it's also fascinating to learn that this club exists. And of course, it's very exclusive. It only makes me want it more.
Well, you know, we have to go by and check it out, Joe. The fact that this has been here, and I've been here for over 30 years, and I did not know this existed. It's killing me. It's killing me.
Well, this session,
now, about the Olympics, the interesting thing is...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, well, no, you, Peter.
In 1972 in Munich, it was a demonstration sport. The thing about the Olympic movement is they just don't automatically bring... And they have a lot of criteria that each sport has to reach, but it has to be a demonstration sport first. And so in 72, that's when it happened the first time. And it wasn't until years later, 1994, when the Olympics were in Spain, that they finally, Barcelona Games.
Yeah, 92.
Sport.
Yep. So it disappeared. It disappeared after 70. What happened, ironically, is that we went in Munich. The next Olympics was held in Canada. Canada knew they weren't going to be able to medal in badminton because it was so dominated by the Euros and the teams from Asia. So they had the opportunity to make badminton a permanent sport by keeping it in Montreal, but they decided we can't win it. They added a specific sport to Canada, something. They're not real logs, but they're fake logs, and you throw the logs, and you throw it, whoever throws it the furthest. Obviously, they gold medaled in it, and they were the only ones who did it. But in so doing, they knocked badminton out of the Olympics until in 1988, the Olympics were in Seoul, Korea,
yeah.
And they, again, were able to introduce it as a demonstration sport. It sold out first of all the sports at the 88 Olympics, and then it went to Barcelona, Spain, and Spain kept it in, which then made it a permanent sport. And ironically, 10 years later, Spain, which was not a badminton country at all, they were terrible, has the number one woman in the world right now, Corinne Marin, playing for Catalina Marin, playing on the world tour, and she's the number one woman in the world, and she's from Spain, and so they were very wise in keeping badminton.
Right.
Okay, so that log tossing competition, I believe, is that called caber tossing?
Yeah, I'll take your word for it. I have no idea. I just know that that's what knocked us out.
Yeah, I think that actually originated in the Highlands of Scotland.
Right.
There you go.
Don't ask me how I know that. Listen, our hour is flying by.
Yes, it
is. We've got to get to the event, the tournament.
Yeah.
Oh, the road to Rio.
Well,
yeah.
Yes.
Jackie, let me make a station break, but we're not going to. Do you want to?
We don't even need a station break now. We're not going to go into weekend. No.
Okay. That's fine. Ladies and gentlemen, there's going to be an Olympic. It's an Olympic trial. Is that correct?
Well, it's a qualifying event. In order to reach the Olympics, you get there based on your world ranking, the same way you do for tennis or any of the other sports So it's one of the events, and it's the only one in the United States. It's the last one now that's going to count towards reaching the Olympics.
Right, right. Fantastic. And it's going to be right here in Manhattan Beach at the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club. And that's fantastic. Peter, tell us a little bit about the dates and how that works for the public to be able to get to see this.
Well, the athletes are going to be coming in the first, second, third, I think the first date of the event is the 4th of February. It is open to the public. We have a website, mdbadmintonclub.com, which talks about the event. For the finals, semifinals and finals on the 6th and the 7th, we will be charging a nominal amount to see those events. But the rest of it is free. We're going to be actually live streaming the event as well.
Right.
So it's very very exciting. The city is very excited about it as well. We've been working with them, so they're pulling out all the stops.
Fantastic! Oh wow!
People can actually go. What'd you say? The 4th and the 5th for free. At the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club.
Correct.
So first you got to find it. First you have to know it exists. Then you got to find it.
Right.
And you can go to the club and watch the first 2 days at no cost, and then the the semifinals and finals on the 6th and 7th.
Right.
$10 a ticket.
Yeah, and it starts at 9 a.m. on the 4th and 5th. It's 9 in the morning till.
I think it starts later now. I think that what they're going to do is start it more in the afternoons.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, they're going to run it in the afternoons on the 4th and the 5th, specifically so people, you know, can maybe get over there in the afternoon and evening. It'll run later into the evenings. And we have an incredible story this year with this particular event, in that both of the men's singles players who are most probably going to make it. One of them is going to make it into the Olympics in 2016 in Rio. One of them is a young man named Bjorn Seguin, and he plays and lives, trains out of France, because as I said a minute ago, it's a huge sport in Europe and whatever. So he plays out of there, and Howard Hsu, who grew up here locally in Southern California, out in Diamond Bar area, who trains, I think, primarily now in Asia. Both of them will actually be here participating and are seeded players in this event. And realistically, it could be a decisive event for whichever one of them wins it. It could put it out of reach for the other. So we're sort of in a unique position here in the men's singles to be really, really right on the firing line of who's going to make the Olympics for the United States.
Hmm.
So these are Olympic players. These are
full-time full-time professional badminton athletes, and it's not what you expect. Like, we had a young man recently come and visit us from Denmark named Victor Axelsen, who's probably now making $2 or $3 million a year playing badminton. You wouldn't know it. He's this wonderful young man, 20 years old, 6'7". If he didn't grow up in Denmark, if he had grown up here, there's no way he would have been playing badminton.
Yeah.
An incredible athlete, just phenomenal jump and all that. And it's one of those things. Yeah, these guys, if you're into it, it's the same thing. You know, you go to beach volleyball, and a lot of people go to beach volleyball to see the athletes, right?
Mm-hmm.
They may not be that into the volleyball part of it, but it's that whole thing. We have a lot of people around the world that go to these events to see the athletes because they are the typical prototype pro athletes, a lot of them. You know, there's some of us who aren't, but the young, stronger ones that are truly, truly in the mix are, as we talked about earlier with the O2, they're really, really, really good athletes.
So this is world-class athletics that's happening. Yeah, world-class athletics. That's exciting.
Yep. It's the real deal. As I said about the men's singles, the women's singles should be pretty competitive. The men's doubles has 3 or 4 teams that are very, very good. I think it's 19 or 20 countries that are going to be represented here this weekend or next weekend at the event that we'll be playing. And for us, particularly here in this, what we call the zone, the Pan American zone, you qualify for the Olympics from your zone. So we have quite a few. We have a really strong young Canadian boy, and ironically, he's one of the kids. We run a big junior international tournament every summer, and we've been doing it for 20-something years. And a lot of these kids, I call them kids, they're in their 20s and 30s, but a lot of these young people played at our club as little kids. And now they're coming back to our club, and there's a lot of excitement for that, too, because they're coming back to a place that they won when they were 14 or 15 years old, and now they're coming back trying to win again.
Wow, that's exciting. That's exciting. So
yeah.
are we now I remember what happened. I remember all the warnings in 1984 at the Olympics about how traffic was going to be terrible. Are the hordes going to descend on the South Bay for this?
No. I've gone out and left a few posters at the local high schools trying to get the odd young person that, you know, would be interested in coming over and playing in our junior program that Peter alluded to earlier, to come over and watch some badminton. But the truth is that in our sport in the United States, even when we ran the World Championships back in 2005 and it was held at what was then called the Anaheim Pond, where the Ducks and all of them play. Even at that stage, we probably only got about 10,000 people, into a facility that would hold 15. It just doesn't have that huge of a following. And usually what gets people out, like what got people out for that 2005 World Championships was the fact that the Indonesians were in the finals versus an Indonesian player who had become an expat for Indonesia and was playing for us, and he was playing with a young man who grew up in San Francisco and played down here. And so there was this huge buildup. And so when you went to the event, it was a huge Indonesian event. And that's who the Indonesians, Chinese, they really come out and support their teams. But in an event like ours, we do have an Indonesian pair, I think, playing in our tournament, but they're not the most famous of the Indonesian players. So consequently, we won't get inundated with traffic. Probably parking around the club will be a little crummy that day, but
mm-hmm.
but
there's always parking along Valley Drive, and that we're suggesting people park west of the club along Valley.
Right.
A huge parking lot there along the...
Going to an athletic event, you could park down in the parking structure and walk 4 blocks. Boy,
right.
That's brutal.
An athletic event, and you have to walk?
Yeah, exactly. I'm always laughing when I go to other gyms or go to other badminton clubs and I see people driving around and they're trying to find that parking place one step from the door. You're going in to exercise, man.
Yeah.
Go for a walk.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so listen, give us the website information again and phone numbers where people can get tickets.
Well, Peter, we'll be selling tickets at the door. So that's that. You don't worry about you know, having to buy anything in advance. The club website is mbbadmintonclub.com. And with that, when you go to our website, you can click on a link, which will send you to the Road to Rio link, which gives all the information about the tournament. So that's
Peter. Does that link also send you to a link for viewing it online?
Yes, actually, we have live streaming. We'll have live streaming of the semifinals and finals. So I think you can also connect to that. Actually, this MBBC Road to Rio, it is a dedicated website. It is mbbcbadminton.com. So we've got two ways to lead you there.
And Peter, is the live streaming is going to local restaurants and hotels too? Correct.
That is correct.
Yeah, it's going to the
Shade Hotel and.
I'm blank. Help me out here. Who's
the Manhattan Marriott, the Bellamar? Those are a couple local hotels.
Yeah, and what about there's restaurants? There's local anyway. There's quite a few local restaurants and hotels that will be airing the badminton live in their facilities. Ironically, of course, that's Super Bowl Sunday, right? So sorry about saying Super Bowl on your airways. The big game. Anyway, so our finals will take place in the morning. So we will not be in competition. Nobody will miss their watching of a football game to view a badminton event. So please take advantage of the opportunity to see something that's unique and different here.
I want to make sure that people get that URL. It's MBBC and then badminton.com.
That is correct.
MBBC.
Make sure you spell it right. Make sure you spell it right.
That's right.
And it's a nice website that they put up just for this tournament, for this event. So it's mbbcbadminton.com. We're located at 516 18th Street in Manhattan Beach, and we also have a phone number if anybody wants to call and check. It's 310-545-9052 for a recorded message that provides the same details. So it's all there, and we look forward to having everyone come and watch some of the best badminton playing in the world right now.
Right. Literally some of the best in the world.
In the world, yeah.
Right.
Well, hopefully some of our audience listeners will get out there and see something new for us, you know, right?
Right.
All right.
But world class, and that's really, we're so proud, gentlemen, Dean and Peter, we're really proud to have you on the show. This is a very, very special thing. It's something all of Manhattan Beach should be proud of, and the history of the club is just amazing.
Yeah, it's always fun, you know. Whether when you live here in the South Bay your whole life, it's not just us. You know, you can go. It's incredible to me when you start finding out like the Kiwanis. There's so many different service clubs and so many clubs that have existed, and we're just one of them. But going back into the 30s, the genesis of the town, and we're just lucky and proud to be part of Manhattan Beach and the community.
Right, wonderful.
The best kept secret.
I think the best kept secret is that once people establish something like the Manhattan Beach Badminton Club, they love it and they own it and live it, and as talk about the children come back and say, our childhoods were good at the badminton club.
Yep, I totally agree. That's well said.
That's fantastic. That's what we love to show and highlight here on the South Bay Show. Dean Schoppe and Peter Steinbroner, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic, everybody. Check it out. It's going to be coming up February 3rd through the 7th, and right here in Manhattan Beach. It's going to be fantastic. Are you going to be showing up, Jerry? Jackie?
You know something? I have a packed weekend. I'm busy. I have a memorial. So.
Oh yeah.
So anyway.
Well,
downer.
We're excited. Thank you, Jackie.
Always a pleasure, Joe.
That's our show, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye bye.